This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new book, The 1% Solution, investigates how the Bush administration's anti-terrorism policies were created and reveals some of the secret dealings as well as successes and missed opportunities in the war on terror. My guest is the author, Ron Suskind. His previous book, The Price of Power, was about former Bush administration Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill. It revealed that the Bush administration started to talk about overthrowing Saddam Hussein in January 2001 at its first post-inauguration National Security Council meeting. Suskind's new book is based on interviews with many current and former officials with the CIA, FBI, White House, and NSC, and the Departments of State, Defense, and Treasury. One chapter that has made headlines is about a terrorist cell in America that was allegedly planning a gas attack on the New York City subway. Suskind says the attack was called off by a leader of Al-Qaeda.
What happens here is that essentially in early 2003, several things happen quickly in a row. One is that by virtue of some arrests we make in Bahrain, we find that Al-Qaeda has invented a device called a Mubtaker. The key is hydrogen cyanide. That's the deadly gas, which has a long history. The Nazis used it. It's called Zyklon B, I suppose, in the gas chambers. And Al-Qaeda and other terrorists around the world have been trying, essentially, for years to figure out a way to deliver it. Well, what they came up with was this device called the Mubtaker, which is an elegant, portable delivery system. It's sort of like two mason jars together in a little paint can, I think is the best way to put it, between the two jars, one of which has, let's say, sodium chloride, the other some hydrogen substance, hydrochloric acid or whatnot. And then in between, a sort of triggering catalytic element that seal that can be broken with a cell phone, just like the other bombs, that mixes these two liquids quickly and sends out a fairly potent cloud of the deadly gas. This Mubtaker comes to our attention, and it's, you know, it causes something just short of panic inside of the CIA. A model is built and brought to the president, and he is, you know, startled. Now, that's the first step. The second step is that we don't know what they may or may not do here, and we tap an inside source inside of Al-Qaeda management. He's linked to them. Up to now, Terry, no one has felt just publicly that we've had a human intelligence source connected in tight to the Al-Qaeda leadership. We do, in fact, and I call him Ali.
We do, or we did. The impression I got from your book is that we no longer have him.
Yeah, we no longer have. We sort of decommissioned him in early 2005, late 2004, because we were afraid he might get revealed by his assistance for us. But at this point, we turned to Ali. He had done good things for the U.S. government for a few months. Everything he had said had been reliable, had tracked. So we go to him and we say, what do you know about this Mubtaker idea? And he says, well, actually quite a bit. And he tells us a startling thing. He says, in fact, there is a Saudi leader of Al-Qaeda who recently met with Zawahiri about an operational WMD cell in the United States that in the fall of 2002 through early 2003 cased the New York City subway systems with the intention of using a Mubtaker device, maybe several devices, and that 45 days away from zero hour, Zawahiri called them off. The key is not called them back, but called them off. This information then gets passed to the CIA and right, of course, to the Oval Office and the Situation Room. It's just a startling moment because essentially it gives us our first real clue into the key questions as to what Al-Qaeda is really thinking.
What are some of the possible ways of interpreting why Zawahiri, the number two in Al-Qaeda, called off this planned attack against the New York subways?
Well, you know, that, of course, becomes the fierce debate inside of the U.S. government at the very top. Obviously, the president, the vice president, George Tenet, Condoleezza Rice, everybody. You know, there are a variety of positions at the start. One is that maybe he called it off because we're putting, effective pressure on the Al-Qaeda structure at this point. Some people felt that. That, though, was, I think, overwhelmed by another sort of counter-argument. The question of, is that because this, this thing, you know, my God, Muptakers in the New York City subways could cause potentially thousands of death. That wouldn't be enough of a second wave. That's the key term. What is the second wave strategy? Meaning that would not be sufficient to what Al-Qaeda is actually planning and wanting for an attack after 9/11, the second wave attack. The view now is that, A, the passage of time without a follow-up attack after 9/11 should not give anyone confidence that some sort of victory has been won. You know, in some ways, Al-Qaeda thinks in long terms, in decades, longer. We think in news cycles. We have a country with attentional issues, let's just say. In some ways, it's clear they're counting on that. They're counting on us feeling self-satisfied and successful, maybe dropping our guard, maybe just not seeing the thing that's coming. Because the key, in terms of what the most informed people in the U.S. government feel, is that the second wave, the next attack, will be bigger than 9/11. That's the idea. So that it creates an upward arc of terror and anticipation between the second and whatever follows that. You know, fear and terror without, you know, the kind of handle of real knowledge is, of course, what Al-Qaeda is all about.
Well, in your book, you say that U.S. officials' assessment is that the homeland is indefensible and Al-Qaeda is going to attack at a time of its own choosing. What leads you to that conclusion? I mean, what were you hearing about that?
Well, you know, I found virtually no one, and I talked to just about everyone under the sun with direct knowledge of the United States position, its strategy in the war on terror. Virtually nobody believes that, in fact, the poorest borders of the United States are truly defendable against an ardent and targeted arrival attack by Al-Qaeda. A variety of things came up in the research for the book that, you know, frankly, were bracing for me. I live in Washington. I've got my wife, my kids. You know, I said at one point, geez, you know, I know almost nothing about the war on terror, really. I know what the official speak is, what I'm hearing. But, you know, there must be more, and God knows there's so much more. You know, the fact is, Terry, is that the idea that we can protect America is probably as much posture as it is reality, and it's a posture that clearly Al-Qaeda, you know, doesn't buy, and they're probably right to not buy it. That's what the research shows.
Is this a good thing, you telling Americans that our government thinks that our borders are indefensible?
Well, you know, the guiding principle of this book is that the American people should know now, 5 years almost since 9/11, what Al-Qaeda certainly knows and in many cases has already responded to in terms of their strategic posture. You know, the dilemma of this war on terror is that it's a war fought in secret. You know, that's a conflict that creates a new kind of tension for us here in this country in a democracy. And a guiding principle of this project from the very start is that this book will contain disclosures, things, information that Al-Qaeda already knows and in many cases has already responded to in its strategies. At some point, and there are people in the government who cooperated at various levels who I think believe this as well. They do believe it. They were asked many, many times, is this something that will somehow be dropping a card in our hand in terms of this global game of cat and mouse, of kill or be killed? And in every single case, they said, no, it's not.
Let's get to the 1% doctrine, which is the title of your book. Why don't you explain? I mean, was it officially called a doctrine before you described it as a doctrine, and what is it?
Well, some people in the government call it a rule, a 1% rule. A few have used the word doctrine. It's really the guiding principle. Again, not disclosed at this point, but it truly is the centerpiece of the United States playbook in this war on terror. And the genesis of it, interestingly, is shown as though you're sort of walking in the shoes of the participants in the book. And I think that's important to show how they arrive at this idea. And it's from a meeting in November 2001 where the vice president is being briefed about the most dire threat at that point, which is disclosures that Pakistani nuclear scientists had met with bin Laden and Zawahiri apparently offered them clues as to how to build nuclear weapons. Cheney's being briefed on this in the Situation Room. There are folks from the NSC and the CIA there as well. And as it starts, he sort of stops the proceedings and he says, you know, we need to think in a different way about these low probability, high impact events. And then he stops and the briefing continues. And it's a harrowing briefing. I mean, it's just 2 months after 9/11. We're worried about a second wave attack. This is really the shared nightmare. And then he stops it and he says, look, if there is a 1% chance that Al-Qaeda can get its hands on WMD, we need to treat it as a certainty. It's not about our analysis or the preponderance of evidence. It's about our response. That's the key thing in that second part, is it's not about our analysis. It's about our response. We are never going to be able to essentially abide by the evidentiary rules of analysis, of search and find, in this kind of effort. It's about action. Action even if we have just a 1% suspicion.
Well, what are some of the potential problems that you see with that policy?
Well, you know, the potential problems is that everything merits a to-be-sure response by the awesome powers of the U.S. government. And when those responses may not be justified, like the sweeping up of lots of folks with Arab names or the capturing and rendition of people who may have very, very little inclination or evidence that is pertinent to us. Certainly many of the excesses we've seen in terms of torture. All of those fall into this category. As well, frankly, much of the debate as to Iraq and WMD, you know, on the outside, in public, we were arguing about evidence. Is there evidence? Is there not evidence? Internally, though, many of the folks said, you know, evidence is beside the point. We've already sort of given up our belief that evidence is really going to matter deep down.
Did people in the FBI or CIA complain to you about this 1% doctrine? Did they complain to you that it made it difficult for them to focus on the most serious of plots?
Well, of course. You know, that is part of the difficulty. What if it's 10 1% threats? What if it's 100? What if it's 1,000? What, A, does that mean for the capacities or resources of this U.S. government? What does it mean in terms of the people who might be bruised or worse in us, essentially saying, better safe than sorry, you know, you now are under arrest, or your phone line is tapped, or all manner of things that essentially, look, evidence is at the key of so much of what we call age of reason and enlightenment ideals that essentially are the foundation of a democracy and certainly of this country. This is loosing us from those moorings.
If people in the Bush administration and in our intelligence agencies believe, as you report they believe, that another attack is inevitable, then what's wrong with a 1% doctrine in which a 1% threshold of a plot is enough to try to investigate it?
There is nothing inherently wrong or right about the 1% doctrine. What people are going to do is argue about it. You know, on one side, you have the issue of essentially a separation, a divorcing of action from analysis and evidence, and we know the perils of that. On the other hand, those who say yes and will say yes, Dick Cheney, go forward, are going to say, is this really the best we can do in this era to create a strategy for a war that's probably going to go on right up to the lives of our grandkids? That's a debate, and it's one that's clearly unfurling and will unfurl because of the book over time, from here going forward.
One of the things under investigation now is how telephone companies have cooperated with the National Security Agency and have handed over records that allow the NSA to see who's calling who. You found that there's a corporation called the First Data Corporation that actually offered to help on the war on terror in any way it could. You say they're one of the world's largest processors of credit card transactions, and they own Western Union. So what have they done in their attempt to cooperate with the Bush administration on the war on terror?
Well, one of the great controversies is the union between the U.S. government and these large companies. It's very controversial. It does create a crossing of key lines in American life. These companies are often brand names around the world as well as here in America. We know about the telecom companies. Here is the first instance where we basically see the other half, is that this giant global net, this matrix that they built after 9/11, sort of as a communications head and a financial body. It's this giant terrorist-catching machine. And on the financial side, the lead player was a First Data, which is this credit card processing giant, owns Western Union. They approached the government a few days after 9/11, and FBI managed that relationship. Many of the sweeps where thousands of Muslim men were swept up or interrogated around the country in the year, 2 years after 9/11, were driven under the surface by the financial information, which does tell you an awful lot, not that the NSA stuff doesn't get you started, but the financial information tells you pretty much everything you'd want to know. And First Data was really running that show. I mean, FBI and First Data set up a kind of outlocation near a big First Data processing center so they could work together and essentially tap into the First Data giant mainframes. And then it gets even more interesting as Western Union, which is early on identified as maybe the gem inside of First Data. They have thousands of offices around the world. They're run by folks who are largely independent. First Data, rather, Western Union is used by the 9/11 hijackers to move money. Western Union takes a step into, I think, a whole nother realm. What they do is as they're being passed from FBI to CIA, they set up a kind of wire transfer trap whereby a bit of information would be offered to Western Union. They would, through a process where it's papered, meaning they go through a Justice Department office. And essentially Western Union knows someone is about to send a wire transfer. The key is who picks it up. And they also then can trace who's picking it up and then give it in real time to folks in the intelligence community. In the case in the book, they essentially offer this information to Shin Bet, the Israeli intelligence bureau, and it changed the balance of power on the West Bank. And the big question is, should U.S. companies be doing this? U.S. companies with huge sort of communities of customers who, frankly, are unwitting. They don't know. Is it better that they not know? Is it better that the brand names of America, Fortune 100 companies, Fortune 500 companies, are in these sort of secret arrangements with the United States governments, the United States government and ultimately governments around the world.
What kind of controversies do you expect to be involved in now? And do you think terrorists are wondering what you know? Do you think people in the administration are wondering what you know? What kind of whirlwind are you expecting to be caught up in now?
Well, it's hard to gauge what's gonna happen or what will follow. The administration's known about the book pretty much from the start. There are people in the administration who were helpful, frankly. Obviously, many who are not in the administration. I can firmly state, if anyone from the jihadist community is listening, that everything I know is in the book, there is nothing pertinent held back. And I think that ultimately people recognize that, it's a very tricky time to be a journalist and to be involved in this kind of reporting in this area. I think though that's part of what we're facing in terms of these struggles. How do you do what you need to do in a democracy? So that there is informed consent. So people essentially are empowered by knowledge rather than simply fear that is rooted in ignorance or, my God, I know what's out there, but I can't know too much. I think people are strengthened by it. And I think that that America has shown that in the past and we'll have to show it in new ways in the future.
Ron Suskind, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, sure. Thank you, Terry. It's been lovely.
Ron Suskind is the author of The 1% Doctrine.